A new analysis from ProPublica has found more than 24 instances in which judges determined New York City prosecutors had engaged in harmful misconduct, so harmful that courts threw out the convictions, but in most instances, not harmful enough to damage the prosecutors' careers. We are joined now by Joaquin Sapien, who wrote, along with Sergio Hernandez, who polices prosecutors who abuse their authority. And we have a link to the article on our show page at WNYC.org. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
What were the most common abuses by prosecutors in the cases that you looked at?
We found that in more than half of the 30 convictions that were overturned, there were, the most common instance was prosecutors withholding evidence that could be favorable to the defendant, and also eliciting false testimony.
Both of those things are prohibited by law, aren't they?
Well, you are supposed to turn over, you know, all witness statements, for example, before somebody testifies, and you're supposed to turn over anything that could be favorable to the defense well ahead of trial.
Are these usually in major cases? Murder,
these
rape?
We found murder cases, rape cases, child molestation cases, and the outcome of withholding this in certain cases was that an innocent person went to jail. In others, it was a guilty person going home early.
One man you focus on in your story is a former Queens assistant district attorney named Claude Stewart. How many cases was he involved in which there turned out to be major problems?
So he had quite a troubled career. There was three cases where convictions were ultimately overturned because of his conduct, two of which became public before the Queens District Attorney fired him forced his resignation.
But he had kept on being promoted before then.
That's right.
Despite the fact that there were problems.
So we uncovered his personnel records through FOIA requests, and we found that he received a string of positive performance evaluations, raises, promotions, things of that nature. And he was really a valued prosecutor for a time, partly because of his quote-unquote uncanny ability to win at trial.
Can you tell us about what happened during the murder case against a man named Tony Bennett, not the singer?
No relation either. So what happened in that case is Claude did not reveal, basically said that the case against Bennett would be based on the testimony of the victim who is dead. And basically a police officer who was at the scene said that the victim said that Tony Bennett shot him. And he said that he was not going to use the testimony of a witness that was on the list. He ended up using that witness at the very last minute, and that witness's testimony is what ended up putting Tony in jail. He was sentenced for 25 years to life. This was his third felony conviction. When an appellate court discovered that Claude basically played it cute with this witness, they overturned the conviction, and Bennett took a plea and was released 12 years early. And then he confessed to me that he was indeed responsible for the murder, and he probably would not have gotten out if the prosecutor had tried the case fairly.
Who represented him?
There was a couple of different defense lawyers. Joyce David was one of them. The other one was Richard Michel during the appellate.
The reason I'm wondering if these kinds of problems are more likely to occur when defendants are represented by public defenders who are carrying heavy caseloads.
Well, in that particular case, it was private attorneys, and I mean, you could argue that they represented him quite well because, at the original trial, the trial defense attorney objected, and that's why it became eligible on appeal, and then they won on appeal, so he got out. But again, these are private defense attorneys, and there's a number of these where overworked defense attorneys didn't quite represent their clients to the best of their ability.
What about the case of Shi Wei Su? What did he go to prison for?
He went to prison for a attempted murder. And what was interesting about that case is that there was a plea agreement between the key witness and the prosecution. That person agreed that he would testify against Shi Wei Su in exchange for leniency on a sentence and a separate charge. And that deal was not disclosed to the defense.
And they denied, in fact, that a deal had been made.
That's right. Repeatedly through the course of 13 years worth of appeals, and then he finally got out. And what we found is that the prosecutor, who knowingly broke these rules, was only secretly disciplined. Her public career remained unsullied.
Well, why would a prosecutor go ahead with knowingly eliciting false testimony if she knew that it would send an innocent person to prison?
Well, she probably believed that he was guilty. She did say in her disciplinary hearing that she was pressured to take the case by supervisors.
This is Linda Rosario.
Right. And there are also – it's Linda Rosario, actually. And there's also some evidence that winning tough cases can get you a good reputation in the office and potentially earn you raises and promotions and allow you to sort of make – a name for yourself.
Well, the city wound up paying Shin Wei-Su $3.5 million. Do most of these cases of prosecutorial misconduct, especially when the defendant is exonerated, end up costing the city large sums of money?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, there's 10 of 30 people who were exonerated, and I think three of them still have litigation pending. But the settlements that have been awarded thus far to the remaining people who have already received their settlements comes to about $17 million.
And the city just pays it out of the general the coffers, or do they have insurance?
That's our money. That's taxpayer money that we – so we pay for prosecutors' mistakes in those cases.
Sue,
not to mention we pay for the prosecutors to begin with.
Didn't Sue want the prosecutor to be held accountable?
He did. He filed a complaint to the disciplinary committee, which ironically is the same functions as an arm of the same body of the courts that reversed the conviction. But they, they saw fit to just issue a private letter of admonition. The only reason why it's public is because Sue's lawyer, Joel Rudin, shared that correspondence with us.
And why do you think that that's all he got, considering the fact that she, in effect, broke the law?
That's a great question. The proceedings are not public, so there's really no way to answer that question, unfortunately. There's just not a lot of transparency here. Complaints go in. We don't really know what goes into the evaluation process unless it leads to some kind of public action, which is like a censure or a disbarment or a suspension, and that is exceedingly rare.
Is this happening in all of the DA offices in all the five boroughs?
We found cases in each borough.
Mm-hmm. So is there much turnover in DA offices in New York?
At the highest levels, no. At the lower levels, yes. I mean, in the Bronx and Queens and in Brooklyn, the DAs have been there for decades. And, of course, in Manhattan for a long time, we had Robert Morgenthau.
Well, aren't the people at the top of these offices responsible for what the people who work for them do?
Yeah, ultimately, they are. But what we found is that the people at the very top of these organizations oftentimes are protected when they commit misconduct. There's an example of this that is really heating up in Brooklyn right now involving a chief assistant district attorney there named Michael Vecchione, who has been excoriated repeatedly by federal judges for his misconduct in a couple of cases, and he continues to work at a very high level. And the DA, Charles Hines, has done everything to sort of protect his reputation, calling him a very principled lawyer.
So this is an institutional problem?
To an extent, yeah. I mean, to be clear, we did, in comparison to the number of cases that these DAs try per year, we found a very small number. It's not as though this is a rampant problem. It's just that when it does occur, the consequences are devastating for defendants, and there seem to be none for prosecutors.
Well, defendants in 10 cases you looked at were eventually exonerated, often after years in prison. Do you know if the prosecutors in those cases continue to stand by the convictions, even if they're overturned?
Oftentimes, the district attorney, yes, they do. They still contend in many of those cases that the person is guilty.
And is that just a matter of denial, or is that a matter of protecting one's career?
It's partly a function of the adversarial system that exists in criminal justice.
Aren't appellate courts supposed to police attorneys? How often do they go after prosecutors who make major errors?
Well, they're their first backstop. So when someone appeals on the grounds of prosecutorial misconduct, they're the first people to review that allegation. And if they find that it occurs, they can either say, Yes, it happened, but it didn't affect the outcome of the trial, so we're going to let it stand, or they can reverse the conviction. The problem is that what we found is that the appellate courts don't actually report prosecutors to the disciplinary committees when they find misconduct.
Would they go after a defense attorney who had convinced a witness to lie on the stand?
You know, it's hard to say whether or not these two are receiving equal treatment. There's certainly a lot of instances where defense counsel doesn't provide effective counsel. I don't know how frequently they're disciplined.
Even if there are egregious errors made in a case, how often does that result in an appellate court overturning a conviction?
Well, we found about 85 cases where appellate courts looked very closely at misconduct, and in over 50 of them, they upheld the conviction. They said, yes, the prosecutor overstepped his bounds, but it didn't affect the outcome of the trial, so we're going to let the conviction stand. And then 30, they reversed those convictions. And many of those don't get reversed until they're reviewed by a federal court, which, of course, takes many, many years and a very strong case in order to be looked at that level.
Has the New York State Bar Association taken up this issue?
They did a wrongful convictions report in 2009 that looked very closely at this. In fact, a number of proposals to change the system of oversight were pitched to the New York State Legislature. None of them passed. The New York State District Attorneys Association is quite powerful in Albany, and they were able to stop any real reform.
My guest is Joaquin Sapien, who, with Sergio Hernandez, wrote Who Polices Prosecutors Who Abuse Their Authority for ProPublica. We have a link to the article on our show page at WNYC.org. Can you tell us about the case of, is it Amin Baba Ali?
Sure. That's a child rape case. And what happened there was a 33-year-old Algerian man was in the midst of a very nasty divorce with the woman he had his daughter with. And she accused him of molesting this child.
Which is not uncommon.
A nasty divorce proceeding? No, yes. That part of the story is not uncommon. What is uncommon is she took this child to several doctors before she found one who said that the child had been molested. And by the time she got around to seeing a doctor who came up with that report, it had been over 3 months since the father had last seen the child. And the prosecutor had all of the medical reports showing that no abuse had taken place, and yet she chose not to turn those over until the night of the trial. The defense didn't end up using that material. The man served 2 years in jail, witnessed all kinds of atrocities, saw a cellmate, a fellow inmate, serially raped, you know, was assaulted in prison. And he filed a lawsuit against the city, and that is still being contested.
So the prosecutor in that case, Elizabeth Loconsolo, has she been admonished for mishandling the case?
To my knowledge, she's currently general counsel of the Nassau County Sheriff's Department.
So she's been promoted.
Well, she went on to work at a very important public service job. She got promoted in a big way after the conviction was obtained and transferred to head a bureau after it was reversed and got a series of raises while it was on appeal.
When you spoke to former prosecutors, what did they have to say about all of this?
It depends. Some prosecutors said that there is a highly ethical culture, that they're trained to turn this material over as soon as possible, and that the supervision is intense. Others said that there was a, that at times prosecutors could be pushed to maybe take shortcuts.
Well, you note that between 2001 and 2009, just 1% of the roughly 91,000 complaints filed against prosecutors at disciplinary committees resulted in public sanctions. That's just 900 or so, isn't it?
Well, that's not totally accurate. I mean, there was 91,000 complaints about attorneys in general. That includes private attorneys. In fact, the bulk of complaints are about private attorneys. They get complained about all the time. In fact, we found private attorneys could get suspended or disbarred or censured for taking a nominal amount of money from a escrow account. But if you deprive someone of their liberty by withholding evidence in a criminal case, nothing really happens. So there's some real inconsistencies in the disciplinary system.
Well, this all suggests that there is a certain amount of pressure put on the ADAs to get convictions, even if the evidence is shaky.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in...
Is that because district attorneys are elected and they want to show a high success rate?
That's probably part of it. There's also can be a lot of media pressure surrounding certain crimes.
A high-profile case.
A high-profile case. I mean, there's a fascinating case that was just where the Brooklyn Conviction Integrity Unit investigated a case against a man named David Ranta, who was accused of killing a rabbi in Brooklyn. He served 23 years. They found that the detective was responsible for not sharing information that could have led to him being exculpated. What's interesting about that investigation is they never mentioned the prosecutor who was actually responsible for obtaining that conviction.
Is part of this withholding evidence a negotiating tactic when they're working on a plea bargain?
It depends. I mean, you know, we don't really have access to what happens when a plea bargain is reached. Those records are sealed. So what you hear a lot is that the cases of misconduct that are available for the public are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we don't know. Most cases never go to trial. Even fewer cases than that are ever appealed, and that's the first time we ever get to look at them.
Well, poor defendants often don't have the money for appeals, so some of this misconduct probably doesn't ever come to light.
That's a totally fair assumption. Yeah, I mean, I think that the records support that.
Well, what about the legislature in Albany? Are lawmakers even interested in this issue?
Some. But what happens is that when there's an interest in this, the prosecutors lobby through the New York District Attorneys Association, which is quite powerful, is able to say to legislators, this is going to make you appear soft on crime. These ideas for reform are impractical. They're unrealistic. They're going to adversely affect public safety. And nobody wants to look soft on crime in front of their constituents, so the legislation doesn't get very far.
Well, we do have a very high incarceration rate, not just in New York, but in the whole country. We have more people in prison per 100,000 than any other country in the world.
And prosecutorial misconduct is one of the many factors that's now coming under a lot of scrutiny as to, you know, what's led to such a high incarceration rate.
Two men are suing the city for $240 million over wrongful convictions for which they collectively spent 36 years in prison. Is that an unusually large amount of money in cases of this sort?
Well, the dollar figures always make headlines. They ultimately end up settling for a lot less than, you know, what the city is sued for.
So what can we do to open up this process, or is it almost impossible?
One solution that could be done very easily and was pitched to us by a number of former judges and former disciplinary committee people is if the chief judge or the presiding judges in New York mandated that every time a conviction is overturned by an appellate court, it must be investigated by a disciplinary committee. There is an obligation that disciplinary committees investigate all allegations of private lawyers stealing money. There is not something similar to that for criminal cases.
We have about 15 seconds. What have DAs said in response to this article?
They've said that even in these cases where courts say that the misconduct was harmful and that in some cases it was deliberate, that these amount to inadvertent errors and are only a fraction of the cases that they try per year.
Joaquin Sapien's article, which he wrote with Sergio Hernandez, is called Who Polices Prosecutors Who Abuse Their Authority? We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.